And good evening and welcome to Bird Calls from Red River Radio, made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. We invite you to call in with your questions tonight about our feathered friends and the avian world during this show at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he is ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997, and he has been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is also the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M Press, and he has authored over 60 publications on birds. He and his wife, Julie, and their two kids live in East Texas. Cliff, welcome back.
Love being here.
All right. And once again, if you have questions tonight, give us a call at 800-552-8502, or you can go online right now to redriverradio.org. And Cliff, at the end of last month's program, you gave us a conservation tip. Can you refresh our memories about what that was?
It was good timing. That would have been March, and we talked about hummingbird feeders. And the conservation tip is that, you know, you don't just stick a hummingbird feeder out and hope for the best. There's some maintenance and responsibility involved, and namely with keeping it clean, making sure the ratio is correct, always four parts water, one part sugar, never any other kind of sweetener, just white table sugar that everybody has and has access to, and then regularly cleaning that feeder out. A mistake a lot of people do is they put a feeder up and they say, I'm not going to change it until they drink it all. And that's a mistake in the hot south. You want to replace it every 3 or 4 days. So if that bothers you, just don't fill it up to the brim. Just fill it up halfway, but still replace it with fresh nectar every 3 or 4 days, because it kind of spoils. It's like feeding your kids sour milk.
Well, basically, it turns alcohol, doesn't it?
Well, maybe so, and that might be appealing to some listeners, but it's not appealing to the hummingbirds. So
no, drunk hummingbirds are not fun.
We don't want any of the birds to be drunk. They fly into windows, and that's not at all. So place your feeder several feet away from a window or shrub. The window, of course, because they can fly into it when they're fleeing away from a hawk or something. And the shrubs, you don't want them too close to the feeder because your neighbor's cat can have an easy grab on your hummingbird. So give them a chance to see a predator coming and get away from them.
And this month, we're going to start off our program with this month's spotlight. I'm going to go ahead and play a little bit of a bird sound for you, and then you can tell us all about what we're listening to.
Great.
This is a familiar sound. Most people hear this around the country.
Yeah, I think this month is an easy one. Let's listen again. Here's some more. This month is the blue jay. So we're going to talk about the blue jay for a minute. In the Red River Radio listening area, we have several species of songbirds that are predominantly blue, including the eastern bluebird, the blue grosbeak, and the indigo bunting. But the blue jay is the only one here with a crest. A crest, by the way, is a tuft of long feathers atop the bird's head that they can raise and lower. And speaking of raising and lower, when they get excited, they raise it up. And let's listen to some that are mobbing.
So you can see how that pitch has gone up and almost the intensity has gone up.
It's rapid. There's several blue jays. There's also, you can hear a chickadee and a cardinal. These are birds that are mobbing a predator, and they'll do this. It's like a neighborhood watch program. They're out to if there's an owl or a snake or a cat, they're out to shoo them away so these guys won't become their lunch. So they've taken that element of surprise away from the predator by mobbing the bird, this predator, and then everybody knows he's there, and the predator's like, oh shucks, I guess the cat's out of the bag, and I can't scare these guys and pounce on them, so I'll move on. So these blue jays are really good mobsters, and that if you tune into that mobbing sound when you hear three or four jays doing that. we do this. My wife and I, we run in the backyard or wherever it's coming from in the front, and we look to see what it is. Usually it's a barred owl. They really give the barred owls a rough time. Jays are related to crows, ravens, and magpies. They're all collectively known as corvids, as in the family Corvidae. And corvids are considered some of the more intelligent species in the bird world. Blue jays are so popular, they even have a Major League Baseball team named after them. How about that?
There you go.
And blue jays are found in a variety of habitats, from rural and remote forests to urban backyards and parks. So forests or trees are really the key. So here in the Red River Radio listening area, where the species is so common, it's our only jay species, we take their beauty for granted. That is, until you bird alongside someone from, say, California or England, and they see one for the first time, and they're just blown away by the magnificent color. So, yeah, I'm guilty of taking that color for granted as well. The blue jays here year-round, except in the fall when we receive a big boost in numbers when more northerly breeding jays migrate south to pass on through or even overwinter with us. So jays cache seeds in the ground, which means they store them, and that makes them sort of the original Johnny Appleseed by planting and maintaining our forests. So the idea is that they hide stuff or cache stuff for later use, but a lot of times they forget it. But guess what? That oak or pecan becomes a tree in the future. So their mobbing behavior, we talked about, it can really lead you to an owl, a snake, a cat, or some other predator, so tune in for that in your yard. Many listeners might not like knowing that corvids are regular nest robbers in spring and summer. They're fond of protein found in other birds' eggs or nestlings. Can't blame them. But along with some species of raptors, corvids were apparently real susceptible to West Nile virus than the average bird. So some areas of the U.S. experienced declines in corvids due to West Nile virus when it was first discovered here in the U.S. in 1999. But according to over four decades of breeding bird survey data, however, the blue jay numbers are pretty stable across the U.S., so the species is in pretty good shape.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we invite you to call in tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. With any questions you have about our avian world tonight, we're taking calls about birds, and we'll take your pledges later. But, you know, if you want to go ahead and make your pledge and then send the call in here, that would be cool, too. Now, we had, after last month's show, a couple of photos sent in and by Mark Crawdaddy, and he submitted these images. And his simple question was, are these doves or pigeons?
Yeah, and these are pictures that are typical of a fairly new invader to the U.S. It was introduced and is now widespread in my state of Texas. They're probably in all 254 counties, and that's the Eurasian collared dove. So it's a big dove. He's much bigger than the mourning dove. He's even larger than the white-winged dove. He's kind of a pale pearly gray, and then he's got this ring around the collar. He's got this black nape mark that's where he's named collared dove. So I think a lot of people see him at their feeder. They're fond of seed feeders. They'll come to your backyard and you'll wonder, what is this ghostly, almost white giant dove? And it's the Eurasian collared dove. They were introduced in the U.S. They made it to Texas in the mid-90s. So Louisiana a little before that. So our first sighting was, I think, 95 in Texarkana. And then ever since then, they've just spread like wildfire, and they're statewide. So they're statewide as well in Louisiana, Arkansas, Mississippi, the rest of the Red River listening area. They're just a common bird, and they're usually associated with people. So they're not in the most remote country places, unless it's agriculture and there's grain silos. That's where you can find collared doves out in the countryside.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502 with any questions about our avian world. And Cliff will be happy to answer those questions for you. Now, a couple of weeks ago, you were far away.
Yes, I had the opportunity to visit a friend in Argentina, and he's an ornithologist there. And I visited him in 2013 and had such a good, such a great time. I told a mutual friend of ours who lives in Atlanta, and he went a year after I did. And so then after he went in 2014, I said, okay, the three of us need to get together sometime soon. So we did it. And I spent 2.5 weeks of April going all over the country in Argentina. And the bird life there is fantastic. The people are great. The weather was great. It was the start of fall in April. So in Patagonia, in the southern part where we went, there was fresh snow on the mountaintops. The trees were changing color. There were beautiful yellows and reds. It's just a gorgeous place. I really enjoyed Argentina.
Well, while you were down there vacationing, I was out recording a bird for you, and I wanted to play a little bit of this. This was outside of my patio door, and I was like, well, it sounded almost like a distress call, but I'm used to the other birds. This was a new call, and I wasn't familiar with it. So what do we have here?
Yeah, you can even hear, I guess, is that traffic in the background?
Yeah, probably.
So we've got
a
very urban setting here. And let's listen for a minute. You can hear an inflection right there. This is a begging northern mockingbird. This is a young mockingbird that's begging. And you'll notice these in the springtime. They're speckle-breasted. So mom and dad have no speckles at all on the chest, but a young bird fresh out of the nest has spots on the chest. But otherwise, he looks like a mockingbird. The tail's really stubby, but it's just a young mockingbird, and that's what you recorded, which is pretty cool. So that's an indication that birds are replacing themselves and breeding is ongoing, and we have several months left depending on the species. We have a lot of birds that are just now starting and a lot that will continue on into the summer. This is a good time to be out listening for birds because a lot of the males are on territory. And that's one way they defend the territory is to sing and let other males know that, hey, this territory is occupied. This is my home. So, and speaking of home, I want to get back to the Argentina thing. What was really cool was we also wanted to see where some of our birds here in Texas and Louisiana overwinter.
Ah, okay.
So we saw places where bobolinks and eastern kingbirds winter. We went to the coast and even witnessed in early April, about April the 11th, we had red knots, Hudsonian godwits, white rump sandpipers, and American golden plovers. These are four shorebirds that were on the coast. They were already heading north. And it's just impressive to think that these guys were about equal with Buenos Aires, and to think that in a couple weeks they're going to be in the tundra breeding. So here I got on an airplane to make that big trek from. I flew direct from Houston to Buenos Aires, took 10 and a half hours in the air. These birds are doing that on their own. So it was really a neat thing to see. And I really liked going down there to see not only the birds that are endemic to Argentina or only found in South America, but the birds that we share. So we don't always think about that we here in the Red River Radio listening area share birds that migrate south to other countries, including Argentina. It's pretty cool.
And they actually do that trek without any air traffic controllers and no radar systems.
That's right. No, there's no TSA going through their luggage either.
Yeah, and they have no navigator on board.
No,
amazing.
That's right.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Gail from Marshall, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
I'm thinking that I'm seeing an indigo bunting on my bird feeder. I don't see him often, and I'm pretty sure he's a him because he's bright teal blue.
Mm-hmm.
He's larger than a purple or a house finch, a little bit smaller than a bluebird. Is it an indigo bunting, and are they rare?
It probably is an indigo bunting. There's also blue grosbeaks, and they'll sometimes come to the feeder, but I get a lot of calls and friends that witness a lot more indigos at the feeder. And it is a male because the females are dull brown. They're just a wood color. They're not even very exciting, but the males are exciting. They're bright blue and sky blue. And they're not rare. They pass through here and they're probably not going to stay at your feeder very long. They're going to head to the countryside probably to nest. They're very common They're actually one of our birds that's doing fairly well, that's not in trouble, so that's good. But I see indigos in a variety of habitats. They like shrubby, scrubby areas. They like regenerating pine plantations, which were formerly clear cuts that are regrowing. They like open pine forests where the trees are spaced well, and there's usually prescribed fire. And open, the very openness, and they like that as well. So they like a variety of habitats. But in migration, especially spring migration, they'll hit the seed feeders. Also, rose-breasted grosbeak. We get a lot of calls about, what's this black and white bird with red on the chest? Looks like it has a bleeding heart. Well, that's the male rose-breasted grosbeak, and he's a migrant. He doesn't even nest in Texas or Louisiana. He's going on to Nebraska, or Minnesota or Michigan to breed. It's just stopping off to refuel like we would on a long journey, and we'd stop to get gas and get a snack. That's what these birds are doing, and that's what that indigo bunting's doing.
So I won't have him all summer?
No. I mean, unless you're right up against breeding habitat. But are you in an urban setting surrounded by neighbors?
Very urban.
Yeah, if you're in an urban setting, he's not going to be there long, so enjoy him while it lasts. If you were out in the country and you had that pine plantation next door, then you might have him all summer. But if you're in an urban setting like I am, he's just going to be there for a few days. And another one might replace it, but you can't tell Bill from Bob in the indigo bunting world. So you don't know if it's the same one or a new one, but this is just going to be a bird stopping over to refuel during migration. Yeah.
I see. So the gale's bed and breakfast, and off we go then.
Yes. So charge him while he's there, because he's going to fly the coop here in a little bit.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Gail.
And you are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call tonight, anything about birds, at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And Mitchell from Alexandria is online next. Mitchell, what's your question tonight?
Oh, I had a question about a diving bird that... It looks like a large cormorant, but it's much larger, and it's not black. It's a gray, had a white throat, and I looked it up. It looked like maybe it was a common loon. I just can't believe that they're down this far.
Well, if you looked it up and it matched, that sounds like it could be a winter plumage of a common loon. The one big difference is the way they held their bill. The loon holds it very horizontal on the horizon, whereas a cormorant's kind of snooty and tips his bill up a little bit. But yes, we do have common loons, and they'll stick around into May. I've seen late ones into May, and some are starting to change into breeding plumes, but a lot of them still are in winter plumage, which sounds like what you experience. So, and also there have been injured birds. A lot of people have common loons all summer long, and we can only guess that they're probably injured, maybe old ones that couldn't make the migration north again, which is too bad, because a common loon's a smart bird. I mean, he gets out of here when it starts getting hot, and he heads up north where it's so cool and refreshing. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of sad, but I mean, it's probably an injury if he's still there deep into June. But I think we do have some records into early June. But another thing about loons, they're so heavily feathered with down feathers to keep them warm in that warm climate, that I think if they don't make that migration, their body is not going to know it, and they're going to get that loon plumage. And I would bet that they get pretty doggone hot here. So I'm not saying it's going to kill them, but it's got to be miserable for a loon to be here in the summertime. But I have seen them linger into May on our reservoirs. And so did you see it recently?
It was about 4 days ago. Yeah. It was on one of the lakes here in central Louisiana.
Yeah, and so I would say you probably caught one of the later loons to get out of here, and the smart ones have already left. They're headed north.
It was by itself, and it could really swim a long way underwater.
Yeah, and so it's really tough to determine if a loon is injured, because you think, oh, well, let's go catch it and we'll rehab it. No. You're going to get within 10 meters with your boat, and guess what he's going to do? He doesn't know you're coming to help him. He's going to dive, and you don't know where he's going to come up. So it's futile. It's not. It's worthless to even try saying, let's go save that loon. I know his wing is broken. If he can dive, he'll be able to fish. He'll be able to eat, and he'll be able to live. But there's no way you're going to catch him. They are, he's going to go underwater and come up 75 yards to your left, and you're going to. Yeah, so we don't really know if loons are injured unless there's an obvious sign like a wing is bent upwards or something like that. But he might look okay, but he could be just an old loon. I don't know how old loons can get, but I would think they live over 15, 20 years, and it could be an old guy that says, I'm just not going to make the trip this year. So, but I'm hoping that your bird is just a late one and going to take the late flight out.
Well, it was just a really big bird, and I was really surprised, and I knew it wasn't a cormorant.
Yeah, and I've been on Sam Rayburn in East Texas in spring when they, at one point, I'm talking about a place I was stationed on a peninsula. On one peninsula, I scanned the water and counted over 70 loons. Mm. And that was clearly birds that were staging and moving because there weren't that many a month earlier, and there certainly would have been not, there wouldn't have been that many later. So I think I just captured that one moment in time when they were stacking up and staging and moving north. So. That's probably what you saw, and common loons are here. They're
all right.
Yep, very good.
The same loons that are you find up in Ontario?
Yeah.
And so these are the migratory pathway.
Yeah, and if you're familiar with their yodeling that they make, that's so refreshing. Especially if you have a cabin up there and they're yodeling all night. They don't do that very often. I've only heard it a couple times on the wintering grounds. So they're just not displaying, they're not maintaining a territory in the winter, and the hormones aren't going, so they're not very vocal.
Yeah.
So if you're from Wisconsin, for example, and you know the common loons yodel, and you come down here and that's not a loon, I don't hear it. It's just a different season. He's just got a different attitude, and he's got different things going on, and he's not doing the yodel. But it's one of the neatest sounds in the bird world, for sure.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. He is with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. And you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502 or online right now. You can call, 800-552-8502. Almost went into the pledge pitch there. And we need some more calls. All lines are open right now. So please give us a call right now and ask your question tonight of Cliff. And I do have a quick question here, and that is, now that we're almost at the end of the migratory season, right? Is there anything left that we need to be watching for that's migrating out?
Yeah, actually, I had a Canada warbler singing in my backyard today, and that's not unusual because this is mid-May, and that's kind of the peak for some of the later migrants like Canada warbler, morning warbler, a lot of the Empidnax flycatchers like yellow-bellied and alder and willow. They'll come through pretty late. So it's the tail end, but I've had a June 6 record in East Texas of a black-throated green warbler, and he was singing and fine, and I thought, oh my gosh! So he definitely was not going to breed. The closest breeding is north central Arkansas for black-throated greens, but this one probably is going to go in farther than that. But what I'm getting at is even though this is maybe the tail end of it, there's still stragglers that are pushing through. So the previous caller talking about the common loon, that's probably a straggler that just hasn't left. And that black-throated green I had over a decade ago and near Woodville was obviously a late bird. But he was fine feeding, flying tree to tree and singing, but he just didn't look at the calendar. And June 6, he should not be in Texas. So. So other things to look for right now, tail end of some of the shorebirds. There'll be still some white-rumped sandpipers pouring through. That was one I mentioned earlier that I saw in Argentina. So some of these later birds, it's a combination of things. Some of them have a long way to go. Some of those songbirds I mentioned, they're what we call circumgulf migrants. So they kind of take their time flying around the Gulf of Mexico versus the transgulf migrants, which are in a hurry because there's no stopping over the big water there. You got to make it in 18 or 20 or so hours and race across the Gulf. But some of these guys also have to wait until the breeding grounds are done. There's no rush to get up to, if you're a northern tundra or northern boreal forest breeder and it's still in snow and the insects haven't really bloomed, then there's no rush to get up there. So you have that kind of combination for some of these late migrants. So it's not that they're late, they're just later than your average push of migrants. That would be, in this area, probably about the third week of April is really a great peak for migration, and it'll last for a couple weeks, but now we're tapering off. We're getting to the end of that season. On the Eurasian collar dove we talked about a minute ago,
mm-hmm.
he really sounds like an owl. A lot of the doves do, but this one really does, and it's just an incessant woo-hoo-hoo, woo-hoo-hoo, woo-hoo-hoo. And if you hear that outside in the day and you think, what is that owl? And it won't stop. If you find him, you'll see it's just this big, giant Eurasian collar dove. And to me, it sounds very owl-like, but it just doesn't stop. They're incessant. They just coo a lot. And I guess they're pretty cool. They're just a big, new urban bird that have found the U.S. to be a good place to be.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question revolving around our avian world, bird watching, or birds in general, please give us a call. We have an online question. While walking in the neighborhood, I came across a little unfeathered bird, very young looking. Noticed the bird's parents flying around near the bird. Once picking up the bird, put the bird back down. Is there anything that I could have done for this bird?
Well, that sounds suspicious. I would think that was a nest robber. The adults were probably taking a bird away to eat it, and there are no birds that carry their young like that to help it. So I think that this person witnessed probably a theft of a nestling out of a nest. I mentioned that earlier with the blue jay on our profiled species. In the first few minutes of the show, we talked about how blue jays are a good example of nest robbers. They get protein from stealing other birds' eggs or nestlings, and I think that's what this person saw, because you don't, if a baby bird falls out of the nest, I don't know many adult birds that will pick it up and put it back. Usually it's the end of the life for that baby bird, but I would be curious what the adults were that were messing with this baby bird, but I think this was a nest robbery.
So basically, yeah. The youngin was going to be food.
And we use the word robbery as if it was, theft and you got to go to jail and there should be, you should be sentenced. But this is Mother Nature.
Mm-hmm.
And Mother Nature is tough and rough, and she's not anybody's friend. So it's all about survival. And it's just because you have four eggs in the nest outside your yard doesn't mean all four are going to make it. The chances are that maybe one will make it to adulthood. And actually, in a lot of the studies that are out there, it's usually less than that make it to adulthood. So it's kind of insurance, and that's why a lot of birds that taste good, like quail and ducks, that's why they have 12 or 15 eggs, is they're crossing their fingers, so to speak, hoping that, if we can just get one of these to survive. But when you're a duckling, you've got turtles wanting to eat you, largemouth bass, you've got herons, you got danger coming from all directions. That's just the way Mother Nature is. So baby birds don't all make it. It's just reality. It's heartbreaking, but it's reality. It's the way things operate.
And nature is nature. It just doesn't. I mean, it's going to balance itself one way or the other. And that means if a youngin has to die to feed another set of birds, and that's the way it's going to be. Nature has a balancing act.
That's right. And a lot of these songbirds will re-nest. We've Parks and Wildlife has funded some studies on the black cap vireo. I have a colleague who's studied black cap vireos, and he, The data show that they'll nest two and even three times in one given breeding season, and that's sometimes even without having any kind of nest parasitism or nest robbery. They'll crank them out if the conditions are right. So a lot of birds will nest more than once.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call tonight with any question about birds, birding, and our avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff is currently with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, and he's an avid birder, and he's written numerous articles. He's our expert tonight. We have another question online, and that is, where can one find out about bird watching trips? Are there any scheduled? Are there any regular events? Are there any organizations that do this in the area?
In Texas, we have in our magazine and on our website with Parks and Wildlife, we maintain a calendar of events that lists, okay, at this state park, you got a bird hike here, you got an owl prowl there. So I would suggest looking at your state DNR, in my case, Texas Parks and Wildlife website, and look to see if there are scheduled field trips. Tyler State Park, a buddy of mine, Boyd Sanders, he leads field trips at Tyler State Park regularly, and they find really good stuff over there. So I would say that the internet's going to be your best friend, because that's something that, you know, 10, 20 years ago, we couldn't really relay that information. Now, with Facebook and with websites, you can get that stuff out. So I'd say do a little Googling and find out, or target a site. So here in Shreveport, target the Red River National Wildlife Refuge and see if they have any guided trips. And maybe if they get enough calls, they'll get with the bird study group here in Shreveport. Maybe someone will start leading a regular field trip. And maybe they have that. I don't know. I don't live here in Shreveport. But that's how things are they begin.
And yeah. There are Audubon societies that you could probably contact. Go ahead and look those up in your area. But who knows? You may be the one who actually starts a regular bird watching
trip. That's right.
Trip.
Yep. Where I live, we have the Piney Woods Audubon Society that hosts the Nacogdoches-Lufkin area. We also have members that drive in an hour. Because if you're in Milam or Ratcliffe, you're not going to have an Audubon chapter. So they come to our meetings in the Lufkin-Nacogdoches area. So look for your closest hub like that. Woodville does not have an Audubon chapter, but Longview does. Mm-hmm. So it's usually based on the size of the city. I mean, that's the same thing with an airport. Your little towns don't have commercial airports, big cities do. And it's kind of the same attitude with these bird clubs. It's got to have a good core group of people to make it happen.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio. We're going to take a short break now, and then we'll be back in just a second. We've got more calls coming up right here on Red River Radio.
You've heard us say it for just about every single show we air, but in this case, this presentation of Bird Calls is made possible through the generous support of our listeners. If you appreciate having access to this program, and I know it's one of the most popular shows that we air, lots and lots of calls come in during the show, please support it right now with a contribution at 800-552-8502, or you can go online at redriverradio.org. We'll be having a drawing coming up at the end of this show. That'll be for a signed copy of Hummingbirds of Texas by the host of Bird Calls, Cliff Shackelford. Support not only this program, but all of the programs on Red River Radio with your contribution. Again, the number to call, 800-552-8502, or contribute online at redriverradio.org. And thank you.
And we hope you'll do that right now. And also, we need some more calls during Bird Calls tonight, but we do have one online right now. Mark from Shreveport, you are online with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Hello, Mr. Shackelford. It's always a pleasure to listen to you and talk to you.
Hey, great. Thank you, Mark.
I want to add a few things. I heard you talking about the blue jays earlier. And, I have to say that wouldn't you consider a blue jay probably the most angry bird you've ever run across?
They sound like it.
They're always mad. I mean, they're never, ever happy.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you a true story. One day I was driving down the road and I saw this baby blue jay in the middle of the road. And I said, well, let me get out there and pick this bird up, you know, put him to the side of the road. I go to grab him. The father comes out of the tree and hits me in the head and I get a concussion.
Wow.
true story.
Wow.
Anyway, I wanted to ask you a couple of things. Of course, the Mississippi kites are back in the area now.
Uh-huh.
And they're mostly an insect eater, right?
Yes. Insects on the wing, a lot of dragonflies. Grasshoppers, maybe even moths later in the day, but I think dragonflies and grasshoppers are the biggies.
Hey, let me ask you one thing. One day I have a bunch of Mississippi kites that frequent my neighborhood, and I thought I saw one once grab a hummingbird. Could that be possible?
And wait, let's back up. You said a Mississippi kite grabbed a hummingbird?
A Mississippi kite. It looked to me like he had grabbed a hummingbird.
Yeah. I bet it was a dragonfly.
Okay.
I mean, they kind of, at a distance, you see the wings and the little body.
Right.
But I don't think a Mississippi kite, they're pretty weak-footed. That means that they're not going to grab stuff. A hummingbird is, I mean, think a dragonfly is agile, but a hummingbird is, if he knows he's in pursuit, he's going to sway left and right and all over, and I don't think a kite's going to be able to catch one unless he grabs it in the nest. I just don't see it happening. So I'm guessing it was probably a dragonfly and just distant and hard to see.
And I heard you talking about the Eurasian ringneck dove.
Yeah, Eurasian collar dove.
Collar dove, yeah. They're the family of Columbids.
Uh-huh.
And aren't pigeons considered the only domesticated bird that lives in the wild, because you can actually grab one, put it in a cage, and in about 6 weeks they kind of hang around your house?
Well, if you wanted to try that, I don't know anybody.
I know you can do that.
Yeah, you legally can do that. So that's the interesting thing about introduced birds. They have no state or federal protection.
Right.
So
right.
You could grab or capture a collar dove or a pigeon or a starling or a house sparrow.
Right.
In parts of Texas, monk parakeets are introduced. They're not protected as well. Yeah. So I don't think I'd stick my hand, though, on top of a monk parakeet. Boy, if they can crack a seed, just think what they could do to your finger.
And one more question before I let you go.
Sure.
A few years ago, someone in Louisiana had shot a whooping crane.
Hmm.
And I was just wondering how the population is doing down there. Are they having any kind of success with raising any whooping cranes and introducing them into the wild?
Yeah, that's a good question. So in the White River area, not too far from Lafayette, they introduced whooping cranes the hope is that they would be the resident population, meaning they don't make the big flight like the ones in Texas that winter in Aransas National Wildlife Refuge and then migrate up to Wood Buffalo in Canada. So there was formerly a resident population of whooping cranes that bred on the Gulf Coast and in including Louisiana. And so they've reintroduced some birds, and this year is the first time that they've raised young, which is pretty cool. So I saw news of that about 2 weeks ago. I thought that was really cool. So what's interesting, though, is they're trying to keep them resident, although a lot of those birds that they've released that are released in the wild have flown west into Texas and have shown up in places like Dallas and Lufkin and Beaumont, and just, you know, they're lost. They're weird. And I think that also they probably have migratory tendencies in their DNA. They're genetically programmed to migrate. It's really going to be tough to get all these guys to say, we're going to stay here in Louisiana and stay year-round, which I got to say, again, the ones that are Aransas that go up to Wood Buffalo, they're smart. They're getting out before it gets hot and muggy, and the ones in Louisiana have to stick around and stay in the hot and muggy, and that's just me. I'm not a whooping crane, but so I would do the migration, but it is cool that they're reintroducing them, and again, they did breed this year for the first time. And that's a good sign that things will maybe change, but it's very labor intensive. It's reminiscent of what's happening with the Atwater prairie chicken, where there are no wild stock birds left. Everything you see has come from a cage reared bird. Now, some of those birds are breeding on their own, but there was a time where all the wild stock birds were done and gone and buried, and everything left were bred in captivity. So it's taken a lot of effort by man to get atwaters to be in the stage they are. And I have a feeling that the whooping cranes are going to require this kind of effort over the next several decades. This is not something you just you put these birds out, and you do a high five, and we're done. I think that you're going to have to be committed to making sure that you get enough birds to stick around and start this population of resident birds. And so they're trying that with atwaters. It's very difficult. Everybody wants to eat atwaters, prairie chicken. They got so many predators. And then the big thing is that the habitat's not right. And that's the big problem they're having is outside of the refuge, of the Atwater Prairie Chicken Refuge in Colorado County, Texas, there's just not a lot of private land that has good habitat for prairie chickens. And so you can do all you want on that 10,000 acre refuge, but what are you going to do if they do explode? They're not going to have anywhere to go because the surrounding landscape is covered in McCartney Rose, coastal Bermuda, and all these other non-native grasses and other vegetation that are just not working for prairie chickens. So I wish the whooping cranes luck, but I think that, for job security for some folks, this is going to be good. There's going to be a lot of biologists that are going to be employed working to get whooping cranes back in as a resident population here in Louisiana. I think that's cool.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502, 800-552-8502, with any question about our avian world and our feathered friends. And we have lines open right now. We are going to go to Claire from Shreveport. Claire, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Hi, Cliff. Such a big fan. So glad to talk to you.
Hey, great. Thanks, Claire. What's up?
So I'm here in the Shreveport-Bossier area, and right outside my window at work, we have two beautiful little kestrels I've seen hanging around. And they're going in and out of the cavity. There's both a male and a female, and I can't see anything sticking out that looks like a nest, but I suspect that that might be what they're doing. So I was calling to see if this is the right time of the year and what I should be on the lookout
for. That's really cool. So tell me about the cavity. Is it in a tree or a pipe or what?
Yeah, it's kind of like a pipe. It's part of our building, and it's kind of like a beam, so it's pretty enclosed.
Yeah, that's interesting. So kestrels, probably of the subspecies Sparvarius, are breeders in open pine forests here in the Louisiana and Texas south. Some of those birds have become urbanized, and they'll nest in drain pipes. I've seen it on the Stephen F. Austin State University campus in Nacogdoches.
Wow.
And it's okay as long as there's not any rain. But so the drain pipe way up high is to drain the flat roof, and it seems like it's a good place to put a nest until, guess what happens, a big rainstorm. And there goes the nest, the eggs, or the nestlings. You'd have to have about a four-week window or more for it to work. So I think a drought year is smart to use a drain pipe. But in a wet year like we had in 15 and like it seems like we're having this year, I don't think it's wise at all to use a drain pipe. But kestrels will use that in Texas. I've heard about it in Longview. I've seen it, like I said, in NAC. A friend in Houston has seen it using drain pipes. So this is a bird that needs a cavity and can't build it, so they have to use what they can find. And in the absence of these open pine forests that have a lot of green anoles, that's what they really like to eat. They'll eat grasshoppers too and small mice. But in the absence of those open trees, they're using urban areas. There's a lot of food in our urban areas, but not cavities in the trees. Adequate size for them. So I think that's why they're resorting to these drain pipes, and I don't know if that's a good option, a good solution, except, like I said, in drought years.
You are listening.
Yeah, they're great birds. I'm glad you saw them, so enjoy them. Usually our kestrels are here in the winter, and we get just a very few that stick around in the breeding season, so consider yourself lucky.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you, Claire.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question about our avian world and our feathered friends is welcome. Right now, we have a question from an online listener, and that is, what can one do about sparrows and other birds nesting in their house?
Yeah, if it's a sparrow nesting in the house, guess what it's called? House sparrow. Pretty easy identification to make. And they like nesting in any kind of a crack or crevice, or if you've got a hole in the wall or an exhaust vent. If you don't have a hardware cloth over your exhaust vent for your dryer, they will use that. I don't know how that works when that's hot air blowing out. But house sparrows will use a cavity, they'll use a crevice, they'll just place their nest just about anywhere. You can tell it's a house sparrow because they really stuff it thick with dead grasses, thin, wispy, brown dead grasses, and it's just a big mess. It's about the size of almost the size of an NFL football, maybe not quite that big, maybe a volleyball, but a big wad of vegetation, and that can be a problem in the house. So I would say, if you know that's happening, get the nest out of there and cover that hole or that crevice or whatever they're finding. Eliminate that desire that they have to use that cavity or that crevice or that hole in the wall. You gotta plug it up. Otherwise, they're going to keep coming back. People with purple martin houses, they have to stay on top of the house sparrows, because guess who else is looking for one of those apartments next to the purple martin is the house sparrow. So again, that I mentioned it on a previous call, that's not a bird that's protected by state or federal law because it's a non-native species. So you can do what you have to do. Of course, that doesn't mean you can discharge a gun in the city limits, but you can certainly climb up on a ladder and pull that nest out and plug up that hole and end it. Yeah.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We're going to go next to Douglas. What's your question tonight?
I heard him just a little while ago mentioning that we do have loons here in East Texas.
Yeah, and they're mostly here in the winter. They start showing up October, November, and they typically depart April, May. Some of them will even leave earlier than that. So they do not breed here. So they're really overwintering with us. And think about that bird is a bird that likes it likes lakes that are open water, of course. Well, where they breed, a lot of those lakes, what happens in the wintertime? They become solid ice, so they got to get out of there. We don't have that problem here. Our waters don't freeze over, so they winter with us. And so common loons are typically a wintering bird with us. Yeah.
I haven't seen them, but I hear them early in the morning and right about dark.
Uh-huh.
My sister's a librarian in Minnesota, and she sent me the Loons of Minnesota CD
I used to listen
to when I'd fall asleep. But I've never seen the actual bird, but I knew what they sounded like, and I was really surprised to hear you say that.
Yeah, and I mentioned earlier that they're not vocal like they are on the breeding ground. So when we have them here, 99% of the time they're dead silent.
Really?
Yeah, and so they're not in high breeding. They're not being territorial. They're not trying to find a mate. They're just down here for the winter. So they're very quiet. It's not until they get up to the breeding grounds that they do all that hollering and that yodeling that is so pleasant to hear through the night. Yep.
But that is what I'm hearing, you think?
Well,
it's not really vocal.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just short little bursts.
They'll do little bursts, and I've heard that, especially as spring comes on, you'll hear them give a little bit of yodel, but they don't just go on and on like if you've ever experienced it on a lake up north, in the Midwest or Great Lakes. It's just cool, and it's just, we don't have that. They just aren't singing in that at that capacity at all down here.
Okay, well, yeah. Our eagle nest, I think, is raising their second family down here.
Okay,
a huge nest on the lake, and we hear new babies in there now.
Okay, yeah. The if it was a first nesting, they would be fledging by now, or at least gigantic youngsters. So if you got little babies, probably something happened. They probably didn't, unless you know differently, that they probably didn't raise young and start already, because that's a big window of time there that's needed to get the young out of the first nest and then lay eggs, incubate those eggs. And so if you're seeing babies now, I'm betting that they were late to get started, or something happened and they had to re-nest.
The first ones were probably 2 years ago.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm thinking of a calendar year, mm-hmm. Within a calendar year. And these eagles, once they nest and they'll nest every year. They're pretty religious about coming back to the same nest. But in Texas, we found that the average nest itself, I think the average is about 3 to 5 years lifespan, mm-hmm. Because the tree often will tip over or crack or get struck by lightning or a windstorm. You put a big nest like that in a windstorm and you're building a sail, S-A-I-L sail, and it'll knock the tree down. So the bald eagles have to rebuild every 4 or 5 years, probably in Texas at least.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We're going to go next to Ben. He called back. Ben from Dry Prong, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Rain crows.
Uh-huh.
I hear people say rain crow, and I don't know what the heck they're talking about.
Okay.
A fella pointed one out to me the other day, and he pointed out a night herring with red legs.
No. So I had a question for you when they said you're from Dry Prong. I've never heard of that. Where is Dry Prong?
It's where our transmitter is at in Alexandria.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, central Louisiana between Alexandria and Winfield. There's a story about it named after a guy built a grist mill on the wrong branch of a creek in the wintertime. But actually, it was named after a fellow like me that, you know, couldn't get the thing wet when he was young.
Oh, I see. So Dry Prong, I never heard of that. It's a cool name. So the rain crow is a colloquial name for the yellow-billed cuckoo.
Okay.
And so if they pointed out a night herring, you said, that colloquial name or Cajun name is Grosbeak.
Well, I thought the Grosbeak was more like a great blue heron.
Well, all of the herons. I don't think they differentiate. They all taste the same when you put it in that pot. According to Cajun, right? So, but the Grosbeak is your night heron, but I think all your herons and egrets, I think they'll refer to them as Grosbeak. But back to your question, the rain crow is the yellow-billed cuckoo. The name is interesting because a lot of people think, oh, it's a meteorologist. If you hear a yellow-billed cuckoo, it's going to rain. Get your umbrella ready. No, it's kind of been a warped attitude of really, it's one of the few birds that sings during a rainstorm. And so in a light, gentle rainstorm, they're still making their caw, 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 caw. And that's the yellow-billed cuckoo, and that's also called the rain crow. Colloquial name, of course, is the old-timer name. And so you don't hear that very often, but it's the yellow-billed cuckoo.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have time for at least one more question. Tim from Shreveport, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Yeah, I was just wondering about the barn swallows that are nesting on the Jimmy Davis Bridge in Shreveport. And why do they make such a big deal out of that? And if it really is a big deal, what do they propose doing about barn swallows and keeping them out of the bridges in the future,
Well, I think that in Texas, the TxDOT, it's our Texas Department of Transportation, they're doing a great job increasing and expanding several species of swallows because they love those big bridges and overpasses. So to me, swallows aren't really a true conservation issue. We have priorities ahead of them, but the issue is that once the birds have laid an egg, that nest is protected. So I don't know the exact issue you're talking about, but I suspect it's one that constantly is at my on my email or phone are people that are doing construction and they don't like the swallow nest. The nests are getting in the way. Well, you have to be vigilant. Knock the nest down before an egg is laid, and you can do that legally. But once a bird has finished building the nest, and laid an egg, it's all over. You cannot deal with it. And there's federal and state migratory bird treaty act laws that protect that bird while it's nesting.
They're endangered?
They're not endangered at all. No, and like I said, the Department of Transportation's around the U.S. are helping barn swallows. They're making cliff swallows expand and even cave swallows too. So they really like these bridges and overpasses. So no, they're not endangered at all.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist Cliff Shackelford. And Cliff, we're going to close out this program with another conservation tip. What do you have for us this week?
Yeah, in this month's conservation tip, we're going to discuss bird bass. So last month we talked about hummingbird feeders, and so we're going to talk about bird bass. So by bird bath, I mean the popular cement kind that sits atop a pedestal. If you're able to provide only one backyard item for birds and you're leaning towards a bird feeder, instead, I highly recommend a bird bath. A bird bath is important year-round, but it's obviously imperative during those long periods of drought, and you'll see more species of birds using a bird bath than you would using your seed feeder. All year long, most birds need open water to drink from, and many of those same species also bathe regularly in order to keep their feathers clean and free of ectoparasites so they're able to fly. So keep your bird bath clean, filled with water. Refill it as needed or at a minimum twice a week. That'll ensure that it's always ready for your favorite backyard bird. You'll need to refill it after that bathing blue jay, the species we profiled in this episode, because they really splash around and knock that water out. Since birds also drink from a bird bath, you want to avoid chemicals or soaps when cleaning it. Simply drain the water and let the bowl sun dry in the hot sun for several hours. Keep nearby vegetation pruned back so the neighbor's cat can't pounce easily on any unknowing bird at your bath. And here in the mild south, you don't need to buy that store-bought device sold as a bird bath heater, since water rarely freezes here in the winter. Soon you'll notice which species of birds bathe regularly from your bird bath, but you'll also notice which ones don't. And I'm not going to spoil the fun by listing which ones do and which ones don't use the bird bath, because I want you to discover that on your own. I hope you decide to provide a bird bath in your backyard. Do it for the birds.
Thanks, Cliff. You have been listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio. He is also the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. And we want to thank everybody who called in tonight and the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for their help on this show. And I personally want to thank Cliff once again for being our expert tonight.
Thank you, Bill. It's a lot of fun. Thanks for your help, Bill.
You bet. This has been Bird Calls from Red River Radio. Our producers for this show are Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford, with help tonight from Wally Derleth, Renee Moran, Henry Edwards, and Tim Schnell. The audio for tonight's program will be posted to our website in the next few hours, and you can listen to this program again online at redriverradio.org. And remember, if you have a photo or sound clip of a bird and you'd like Cliff to identify it, you can send it to my email address. That's wbeckett@lsus.edu. Stay tuned, Radio Lab, coming up in just a few moments right here on Red River Radio.